Is there a special mountain in your life?
God, I hope we can find this.
Yeah.
David Hinton, who lives in northern Vermont, told us about the one he knows best.
Okay, so let me talk you through this. Okay.
Hunger Mountain.
So here we are, starting here. Go down that to the bottom of the hill. That's like 1 mile or so.
It's the nicest hike that I know of around here.
Okay. So, yeah, you'll go down this steep hill and it'll hit another road.
Okay. The hike is mostly through hardwoods.
There's a sign on a tree that says trail.
So it tends to be open and airy.
There's usually a little cairn on your left.
It has a few streams you cross, which are nice.
There are like three potential trails down.
You just have to make sure that you come down.
And then the last quarter of the hike is scrambling up bare rock.
Yeah, well, once you get onto the rock up there, there are blue blazes.
And then finally, the summit is bare, so you have nice 360-degree views.
Okay. So if you get a little bit lost, just stop and look for a blue blaze. If you can't find one, just keep looking.
Great.
How many times do you figure you have climbed Hunger Mountain?
I think maybe 300. I've been here over 30 years, and I probably have averaged once a month.
That's a lot of times up the same mountain.
So why would anybody want to hike the same mountain 300 times? Well, David Hinton is a poet and one of the foremost translators of classical Chinese poetry, work that's steeped in mountain landscapes.
Well, here's the cairn trail. Okay, up we go.
Ancient China had a long and deep philosophical tradition based on centuries of investigating the very nature of consciousness. So when David hikes Hunger Mountain, he's following in the footsteps of the sages and masters for whom mountain walking was a core spiritual practice. Today, Steve and I are following in his footsteps.
The sacred isn't really a concept in ancient China. It's, for them, the closest thing to the sacred is something like reality itself or the cosmos, seen as a living, constantly transforming tissue. And spiritual practice in ancient China was all about belonging to that tissue or integrating or weaving consciousness into that tissue. There were a lot of ways they did that, but one of the easy ways was by emptying their mind, which involves meditation or maybe just walking in the mountains.
This is one of the prettiest trails we've been on.
If your mind is empty, it's as if you were a mirror, an empty mirror looking at things. The ancient Chinese spent lots of time in the mountains for that very simple reason, because their mountains open that empty mind mirror. And that's why they thought of mountains as great teachers, so that the cosmos, the landscape, is self. There is no distinction. And there's a poem for that. This is a poem written in the 8th century by Li Bo. It's called Reverence Pavilion Mountain, Sitting Alone. Birds have vanished into deep skies. A last cloud drifts away, all idleness. Inexhaustible, this mountain and I gaze at each other, it alone remaining.
There's one of the blue places.
Is there any particular ancient poet you've come to know who you can imagine walking on Hunger Mountain with?
Yeah, they're my best friends. Because I translate a poet, I basically live inside that poet's mind for a year or whatever.
You can see where the rain collected from last night.
The first book I did was Du Fu, who's the greatest of all Chinese poets, who lived in devastating times. You got to middle age, it was the greatest age of Chinese culture, and suddenly there was this huge civil war that killed or displaced 2/3 of the population. And he became a refugee and spent the last 10 years of his life wandering the landscapes around the edge of China. And he somehow, even though he was desperately poor, one of his kids starved to death, he was constantly moving. He wrote like 1,000 poems in those 10 years, somehow weaving landscape and war and destruction, all of that together. He wrote maybe the most famous line in Chinese poetry, the first line of a poem, it's, "The nation falls into ruins, rivers and mountains continue."
So just to back up for, just to talk a little bit about your personal story a little bit more, you're kind of in the middle of the mountains here in Vermont. What is it that attracts you to this landscape?
I think it's just that, you can live in the middle of it. I grew up in the West where you live in the city and wilderness and empty land was all outside of the city. And from when I was young, all I wanted to do was get out of the city and go up in the mountains. If you want a story, my favorite story about Hunger Mountain is probably the mountain story itself. It's an incredibly cosmopolitan mountain. It was formed originally by the collision of the European, the African, and the North American plates. And they pushed up a mountain range as high as the Himalayas here.
Wait, you're saying that at one point, these mountains were 30,000 feet tall?
40,000.
40,000 feet.
And it's amazing that you can sit there and you look at the rock and you can almost see how it's scoured by glaciers. There were once glaciers a mile deep here. But that rock tells you that there were 40,000 feet of mountain above the current summit of Hunger Mountain.
These rocks were already ancient when Jesus was born. Oh God. And when the Buddha was born. It's pretty tall. I think the mountain could shrink somewhere.
When you hike up Hunger Mountain, do you kind of lose your sense of self?
Oh, it comes and goes, I think, like anybody else.
Because I'm just wondering sort of when that notion, that idea, that feeling kicks in for you.
Oh, it's usually maybe something perceptual happens, like a leaf falls, or I have those stream crossings that are like moments where I just ground me a little bit, and the waterfall. Actually, it happens to us all the time. Anytime you see something new, striking, very often there's this moment of just, you're just seeing it. And if you can stop and look at what happens in your mind, you see it. In that moment, I wasn't there.
Is it cold?
I am touched.
Yeah, it's pretty cold.
Oh, it's so clear though. Time for a water break. Ah, just starting to see above the tree line, too.
So it sounds like you're saying that for Zen practice, sort of the object is to get past the language, to get to this point of empty
yes.
mind. But can I point out there is a paradox here in what you're doing?
Yeah, well.
You are a poet. You translate right. Chinese poetry, and you're talking about the ancient Chinese poets. This is all based in language.
You're making me do it.
So what is the problem with language? How does it get in our way?
I mean, language is an incredibly powerful evolutionary tool. It's made us wildly successful as a species. We need language, we need ideas to navigate the world to survive. However, it creates the sense that we're like trapped in our little heads. And for a lot of people, for me, there's something very wrong with that. And I'll just read one more. So this is Wang Wei, 8th century. Magnolia Park. Autumn mountains gathering last light. One bird follows another in flight away. Shifting kingfisher greens flash radiant scatters. Evening mists know where they are. Ancient Chinese poems are built on images. There's no hidden meaning. You just read the poem. Just take it in and let it do what it does to you.
What do you think of the way a lot of those poems kind of just, it's like they just drop you in the air? I kind of like it.
I mean, I'd like the sense that you're not trying to explain anything.
Yeah. Wind in the trees. We're up near the tree line.
David, I'm struck by this whole different worldview that you're describing here, which is just so radically different, frankly, than, you know, the way I tend to see the world. And I'm wondering how you came to think this way. I mean, you know, was there a moment, maybe early in your life, when you were learning Chinese or learning to translate, when it's just like, wow, this is just totally different? It's kind of hard to wrap my head around it.
I mean, for me, for it really radically to start happening was when I started learning ancient Chinese, which is so radically different. My mind was being so twisted around that I had to drink like 3 glasses of whiskey at night just to go to sleep. And I actually tried. I said, this isn't me. I can't do this. I'm not really a drinker. It's not my way. And I actually tried one night. And at like 2 in the morning, I got up and drank 3 glasses of whiskey.
And did it help?
And yeah, I went to sleep. But I had to get up at 5 and start studying again. So
it sounds like your mind did get reorganized.
Then. Yeah, but I do want to say that on the one hand, it seems radically different. On the other hand, I really don't think it is. The ancient Chinese are radical empiricists. It's all about just looking.
Oh, I think we still got a ways to go, but...
Really?
Oh.
When you describe it that way, it sounds less like a spiritual practice and more like scientific observation.
Yeah, it is. The literal meaning of enlightenment in ancient China, of that term, is seeing original nature. That's just like science, right? It's just like seeing what's there. What is there? What is the cosmos? What is consciousness? And how are they woven together? Everything in the cosmos is constantly moving and changing and transforming. And the West loves stability and permanence. That's why you want a soul. That's why you have God. That's why reality is more ideas than it is the stuff all around us, because ideas are permanent, and the West wasn't comfortable with all this change, but China is totally comfortable with it.
Okay, all right, near the summit. It is really steep, just sheer rock, just climbing. Not exactly straight up, but... Oh, it's tiring.
So I want to come back to mountains here.
Okay, good.
And I'm wondering if the notion of kinship with a mountain is meaningful to you.
Absolutely. I mean, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Weaving consciousness and the mountain together, that's kinship. When you're meditating, you watch thoughts coming and going, and I mentioned how hunger has actually, this mountain range has actually been built up to 40,000 feet and erased down to nothing and built up to 40,000 feet twice, and now it's back down to 3,500 feet. So even whole mountain ranges emerge, live their lives, wear away, and vanish, just like thoughts emerge in our mind, go through their evolutions and vanish. That's kinship with the mountain right there. You watch thoughts operate just like the mountain operates, just on a different time scale. You're always thinking like a mountain.
Okay, I'm in the top. I have to say that it feels like a real accomplishment. That last bit just about killed me. But it's incredible. 360 degree views in every direction.
We had a wonderful day on Hunger Mountain, thanks to David Hinton, a renowned translator of ancient Chinese poetry and philosophical classics. He's also a poet and author of one of the best books about mountains ever written. It's called Hunger Mountain, A Field Guide to Mind and Landscape. Check it out.